Okay, so this is Paulina McDougall. It's July 8th, 2013, and I'm here with George Jacobson to talk about the Climate Change Institute. I'm going to put the recorder right here so you can hear both of us well. So let me ask you first, what attracted you to the study of botany?
Well, I got interested really more in ecology than botany initially. And in fact, as an undergraduate at Carleton College in Minnesota, I was in a group of pretty elite biology students, almost all of whom were going to medical school. And I didn't find myself very attracted to that end of biology. And I took an ecology class, which back in 1967 when I took the class was populated by four students, and even none of the other biology students knew what ecology was, and it was not a word in the lexicon in our country. A few biologists knew what the word ecology was. It had been invented by some ecologists early in the 20th century, but it was not a household word at all. But I found it fascinating to try to understand the systems, biological systems, going on the face of the earth. And so I got involved, did some research with one of my professors for a couple summers there at Carleton, and that led, in fact, to my first ever publication in the journal Ecology. And that was fascinating. I got drafted, went away to the Army for 2 years between 1968 and 70, and then came back, and I'd started grad school at the University of Minnesota, which had the first ever graduate program in ecology in the country. It was the first time there was one. And so I was just interested in ecology. I didn't even know plants, animals, anything.
Right.
But I went there, and within about a year, after I came back from the Army, I'd taken a course in plant ecology with a real good professor who turned out later to be one of my two PhD advisors. His name was Ed Cushing. And the other was Herb Wright, who was a famous geologist. And the thing that interested me was that understanding the modern landscape was obviously not enough. Most ecologists were studying the interactions of organisms or maybe a little chemistry and things like that. But I realized that in trying to understand vegetation, for example, we didn't know anything until we knew what came before. I mean, first of all, because of succession, which is, you know, shorter-term changes on the landscape as vegetation matures after a disturbance. But even more, how things had developed as a result of changing climate as we came out of the last ice age, and how recently was it different from today, and you know, all of that. What were human influences in recent time? And it turned out that by coincidence, Minnesota was at the time, and was for a long time, the leading place in the country doing paleoecological research and vegetation history studies, things like that. And I just immediately became fascinated by that. The idea of understanding the time dimension of biology was really fascinating to me. And I was in a place where people were studying modern lakes, but the history of lakes, looking at how lakes themselves change through time by looking at diatoms and things like that. And I just got fascinated by understanding the vegetation dynamics part. And so within a year or so, I was involved in learning how to recognize pollen grains and be able to do pollen analysis of sediment cores, and that led me into my PhD work, which led me here. And so it was really a roundabout way that I ended up being a botanist. It wasn't because I decided plants were neat. It's just that plants were the vehicle by which I could understand the natural world and the changes. And I think plants in particular, because first of all, the plants leave such a good record, sedimentary record, of their presence on the landscape. It's a kind of long-term chronicle of what the vegetation was in any given place in the lake sediments. And at the same time, providing a lot of information about climate. And so at the same time, I became fascinated by climate itself. And although I was a biologist to start with, I would say by the time I had finished my PhD in 1975, I had learned quite a bit about climate. And then eventually when I came here and became part of this institute, I learned a lot more.
Well, 75 was kind of this time when there was a very strong environmental movement in the country. Do you feel like you were influenced in any way by that?
Well, a little bit, but I mean, the Earth Day was a couple of years before that, 72, wasn't it, or something
yeah,
like
so.
That. And so I was just starting my graduate studies in a way. I spent that summer on a glacier in the Yukon. But it was a time when the world had changed. I mean, I was in college in the mid to late 60s when everything changed, because of the Beatles and the Vietnam War and all of that. Really, everything changed. And then the environmental movement came about in the early 70s. And it was a time when we were thinking about, in very simple ways, about having cleaner lakes and all of that. I mean, the big argument in those days, and of course in our limnological research center where I was centered at Minnesota, the big issue of the day was whether laundry detergent should have phosphorus in them. I mean, and it was a huge dispute, almost like global warming today, of whether phosphorus in laundry detergents caused the lakes to get green, which they obviously did. It obviously did. But it was that kind of really simple-minded, low-level question. But people were concerned about it. And in Minnesota, there are so many lakes that turn way too green in the summer, and people like to have their homes there. And so it was an important topic. But ironically, climate was not a big issue then, because it happens that just during that period, but in the late 50s, 60s, and early 70s, when I happened to be in college and graduate school, we were in a brief but pretty extended cold phase. Things got colder, and there were discussions about the coming ice age and things like that. And so nobody was thinking at all about global warming, greenhouse gases very much. I mean, the idea had existed, but that wasn't on anybody's mind in the way it is today at all. And we didn't think about our work as relevant. In fact, I can remember just being genuinely fascinated by understanding these long-term vegetation dynamics and understanding ice ages and long-term climate change. And to me, that was enough. That was why I was doing it. I wanted nothing more. I mean, I was just fascinated. One of the professors in my department was trying very hard to get me to come and be his advisee and study limnology. And he promised me that limnology was where all, you know, study of lakes was, that was where all the jobs would be, and I would never get a job as in paleoecology. But I said, I'm sorry, I appreciate your interest, but this is what I want to do. And I just decided in my mind, honestly, that I was going to get my PhD and do this the way I wanted to, and even if I never got a job, it was going to be fun doing it. That's how I looked at it. And, of course, what I realized later is that doing things that we're interested in is what makes us good at it.
Yeah.
It's when we're really absorbed and fascinated by what we do every day that, you know, we do a good job. And it's not a job, it's fun. And it's the reason why 5 years after I officially retired, I still come to work every day and keep doing the same stuff for no money. You know, it's exactly what it is, because it's so interesting. You know, and that's why I did it in the first place. And now I don't have to go to faculty meetings and things like that if I don't want to, so that's nice. But the environmental movement was there, but it wasn't part of at all what drove me to do this. You know, I think the relevance of what we're doing now and my work as Maine State climatologist, working with people all over the state to start working on adaptation planning and so forth, is it's great that we have something to offer and some perspectives that are really surprising and interesting and unusual for people. And I'm giving another big talk tomorrow night down in Booth Bay about it. But those kinds of things are an outgrowth of what we've done, mm-hmm. but totally unexpected. Right. And I'm glad we have something to offer, and I really do think we have something highly unusual to offer, something that, that people do not have in mind, because most people have no time perspective, almost no time perspective. Even foresters who think they do have a hard time thinking beyond a human lifetime, actually. And we have to be able to think in terms of hundreds and thousands and even hundreds of thousands of years to understand what's going on and put it in perspective. And we do that completely naturally now because that's how we think every day. So our minds just work that way. But I realize in talking to even colleagues in other disciplines related to ours in other places, they just don't. Most ecologists can't do this. They do not. Most ecologists are looking at the modern world and modern interactions, and they cannot realize that the depth of time really matters. But it's actually everything. The dynamics, the temporal dynamics, are everything in ecology and almost all systems, actually.
So when you came here, it was not the Climate Change Institute. It
right.
was the Quaternary Institute. What drew you to the University of Maine?
Well, I'd spent 3 years working in the U.S. Senate in Washington. I was initially chosen to be a AAAS Congressional Science Fellow, and I did that for a year. And then I spent 2 years heading up a subcommittee staff in the Senate Committee on Environment and Public Works. And I was having an interesting time there, and I could have stayed there and kept doing that. But I'd always wanted to be a professor. And I still loved understanding paleoecology and long-term climate things. And it happened that Maine had formed this institute, which was called the Institute for Quaternary Studies, in 1972. And the original plan for that included 10 faculty members. And there were essentially two of each of several different disciplines, one of which was biology. And as it turned out, I was the 10th person hired. I was the second biologist hired. And while I was in my third year in Washington, I got a call from Herb Wright saying that he'd been contacted by somebody from the Institute, and he'd suggested me as somebody who they should consider, and so I should look for the job announcement. And sure enough, I saw it in Science shortly afterwards, and I was stunned, because if I had written the job description for myself, it would have looked exactly like that, exactly. You know, it was perfect for what I always wanted to do. And it was in a place I would like to live, because I'm a northern person. I was just always dreading maybe I'd have to go spend my career in Mississippi or something like that, and fortunately I didn't have to. But so anyway, I ended up applying for the job and ultimately got it and came to work here on April 9th, 1979, which was an odd time, but I had to do some things in the Senate up to that in that spring. So I was drawn because I'd known, even as a grad student, that Maine had formed this institute. And it really, because it was one of two that were formed about the same time in the early 1970s, the one here and the one at the University of Washington in Seattle. This was a collection of people who did just the kind of thing we were doing in our group in Minnesota with geologists and limnologists and biologists and so forth, trying to understand the history of Earth systems with as many independent lines of evidence as possible, to put it all together. And so that, of course, got my interest. When I saw the name Quaternary in a topic in the name of an institute, that was interesting. And, of course, there were some people here already whose names I knew, so that was enticing. So, but, you know, to have a job doing just exactly what I wanted and teaching the kinds, being part of a not only the institute, but a biology department. It was botany at the time, but later was merged to become biology. And so I would get to teach courses in ecology and plant ecology of the kind that I'd always seen myself doing, plus be part of this research group. It's the best fortune I could have had was was to see that ad and to come here. You know, I've felt the same way every minute I've ever been here. It's the perfect job for me, and I feel so lucky that I've been able to be part of it.
When you first came, was there kind of a directive about how the Institute wanted you to do or focus your research, or were you pretty much able to do whatever you wanted to do?
I think we were all encouraged to do what we were interested in. The one thing we've done from the beginning is try to encourage people and hire people who were interested in interdisciplinary work. So that all of us came in with that notion that not necessarily every project, but that we would get engaged in one another's work and take an interest in it. And of course, it was hard not to because it was also interesting. And we had such a cast of characters here. How could we not be interested in each other, really? But the real crux of the matter was that we were to develop good courses and do a good job teaching. And we were to develop a real research program of our own and get it funded. That was the job. And that was the deal Hal made with the university administrators in the beginning, that they would fund our base salaries and so forth and help form this institute. But our job was to make sure the research got funded independently, I mean, up from outside university funds. And that was always the deal, and we've always done it. And we started small and just grew and grew and grew.
Yeah.
Still happening. And so that was all. And of course, coming at it from having been a grad student not long before, I was a little concerned about whether I'd be able to think of things to do. But because I was always impressed with how my professors seemed to know so much and how could they think of all these projects. I did develop my whole PhD dissertation idea by myself, but that was what I did. But I realized after I got here for a few months that just about every time I went to coffee with somebody, there was another idea sitting on the table for a possible collaborative project. And the problem wasn't thinking of new ones. It was trying to decide which ones were valuable and worth spending time, or could be funded, you know, that kind of thing. All those things drove it together. And were they people, the right people involved, and all those things.
Did you find that the funding agencies, such as NSF and other places that you sought funding, encouraged this sort of collaborative research, or was it easier to get something that was more strictly focused on your own discipline?
Well, I think it was a little of both. I mean, people could work in their normal environment in NSF, and if they were known by the project program directors and so forth, they could keep going. But I never found it difficult to interest NSF program directors in things that cut across disciplines. And almost from the beginning, I think partly our institute really was one of the early interdisciplinary groups that was successful in the country. Hal did, as you know, did a lot of research on, followed up on other research about interdisciplinary groups that had been formed in the 60s and early 70s, and found that most of them failed. But this wasn't a novel idea. It's just that most of them were lists of people on a brochure and not really an institution. Ours was a real institution, as much as anything, because of the way Hal set it up with split salaries and the fact that we were embedded in our home departments but still had this connection to the Institute. So we had two real homes, and our salaries, it was critical that our peer-reviewed committees were always made up of people from both disciplines, both our homes and so forth. All of those things really mattered. And so we took it seriously, and I think NSF took it seriously. And when my experience was always that when we came to, there was something that seemed to fall partly outside of the program we were mostly in, that program director would suggest ways to make linkages, and even sometimes he or she would go find another program director and help figure out a way to help, maybe they could fund that part of this project and we would do this one. And we never had any I wasn't aware of any problems with it. I think it was just something that wasn't done very much at the time. But I'm amused now to watch this discussion that's going on about, you know, how we need to have more interdisciplinary research finally and get rid of silos, because we've done it for 40 years, more than that, and really pretty well. And this university didn't stop us one bit. In fact, we had no, I think we've had no within university barriers to doing what we do. We've been able to move seamlessly among colleges, several different colleges at the same time, to get our work done, and worked well with the deans and the faculties at each of the departments, because of course they want successful people too. I mean, the reviews were always set up to protect both the department and the institute, but I think that was based on a fear that there might be separate interests or something, but it wasn't. It was, everybody always wants faculty members who are good scholars and are productive, publish lots of papers, get grants, teach good courses. That's all. And if by being part of this institute they do that and become well known in their field, the departments are thrilled. And they get to, because they get to count all the grant money. We didn't. The grant money always got counted by the departments, not us. So
I'm sure that was probably a factor.
It was.
Making it a positive experience.
It was. Of course it was. Mm-hmm. And Hal and I, and actually I think all the directors along the way, made a real point of working with all of the department heads and the deans to make sure that everything was as seamless as possible, and that we were supporting the departments, and the deans were supporting the faculty members and understood the relationship, and it was always very positive. And I think by doing it proactively that way, you know, not going asking for anything, but going, laying the groundwork for successful collaborations, it really made for very supportive environments throughout. I mean, I can't remember deans ever, you know, opposing something we were trying to do or anything. It was more figuring out ways to help, and because we were helping them look good when you look at it that way. I mean, university administrators look good if people working in their institutions are successful. And if colleges are more productive and get more papers published and more grants, the deans put it on their resume.
What do you think some of the greatest contributions of the Institute have been over the years since you've been here?
Well, that's a tough one, because there are, we could actually go down the line in the different disciplines, and because we've really had some really wonderful scholars, really wonderful, and still do. Some of the original ones are still going strong, and George Denton, for example, is just a towering intellect, and what he's doing globally today, I mean, there are whole disciplines of climate science that talk about George thinks this, George thinks that, and his ideas drive whole programs at NSF. I mean, that's what happens. And you know, Terry Hughes, for all his challenges, was a genius of another kind, who thought in very creative ways about how ice behaves. And he came up with ideas that are still driving the whole field of glaciology. And a few people would argue with that, but it's really true. He thought in such an unusual way, which was part of what got people aggravated with him, but he just had notions that were way different from everybody else's. And that's, of course, what we want in science, are really different ways of thinking about things, even if they're not right half of the time, or even more if they're right some of the time, but really novel, that's a big deal. Because then that leads whole programs, and a number of Terry's ideas became whole programs in glaciology at NSF, and are still influencing how the world thinks about it. And you know, work Ron Davis did on what happens in lakes and lake sediments included lots of novel things, and you know, our archaeologists over the years have done very interesting things. Dave Sanger's whole approach to understanding what was going on with the people of the coast of Maine really is the baseline for how people understand that now. And of course, Dan Sandweiss's work in along the coast of Peru changed, you know, understanding not only what people were doing down there, but our understanding of the whole El Nino phenomenon, for example. And our work on understanding vegetation dynamics and understanding the rates of change of vegetation change through time was really the earliest look at abrupt climate change, times of especially abrupt climate change where the whole world was changing very rapidly at one time, even in very different systems. And things like that, we could go on and on and on in all these disciplines and within each one of them to give some examples. But it's been really a fun thing here to be watching all of these ideas emerge and the data come in. And, of course, now we've got all the ice core work that's come along since Paul Majewski and his crew came here in 2000. And that was while I was director that all started to take place. And so that all has added a whole nother dimension of understanding very high frequency dynamics over a very long period of time in climate. So these are all things that are genuinely changing how we understand the Earth's climate, and we've contributed an awful lot, even though we're still all kind of off working on our own, writing our own papers, but we're quite familiar with one another's work and influenced by one another's work a lot. That's one thing I've realized very often. And I think our students have. You've undoubtedly talked to some of them, but I think our students, after being here for a few years, and then they go to another institution, they find out, you know, none of those other students know anything. You know, they don't know any of these things about quaternary disciplines that are the environment, especially archaeologists, for example, who here have this whole background in understanding ice ages and vegetation change and all of these important environmental contexts for people's living over the centuries and millennia. And they take it for granted that this is how people see the world. Well, actually, they're pretty unusual grad students because they have this in their background. And it's fun to hear students come back and tell us how surprised they were that, you know, that they were almost unique where they ended up because they had this broader perspective. But we take it for granted because we've been doing it now for decades and decades, and thank goodness.
Did the Washington Institute continue?
They're still going. They're called the Quaternary Research Center, I believe. And but it was organized quite differently. It didn't really have different disciplines, and it was largely focused on glacial geology and quaternary geology more than anything. Mm-hmm. But they didn't have the different disciplines, and they didn't have a graduate program. Another thing we did that was somewhat unusual was to have our own graduate program. Initially, especially, it was a master's level program, but it was interdisciplinary in the sense that we really had students from all these disciplines working on projects and taking classes from all these people. So it was really in an unusual offering at the time. And those students, there were some really fine students who came out of and have come out of the Washington program, but really just more classical geological quaternary in nature.
So tell me a little bit about how your own research has contributed to the Institute's goals and overall.
Well, I hope it has. My early studies, even going back to my PhD work in Minnesota, was focused on the dynamics of, in the initial case, just the species white pine and the vegetation it was living within. But when I got here, I had opportunities to pursue that on a, at a broader geographic scale and look at all of Eastern North America. And then it was just about that time that enough paleoecological studies had been done with radiocarbon dating that it was possible to map in space and time how the vegetation changed. Margaret Davis, who, while I was at Minnesota, became chair of the department at Minnesota, was a prominent paleoecologist, and she did the first mapping of some range changes in ranges during the late glacial. But the big change came when Tom Webb at Brown University made some crude maps based on pollen abundances on the landscape through time, maps showing the distribution of different plant taxa over thousands of years since the last deglaciation started. And I became involved in that research quite early on and was involved in publishing a paper in 1987. It was actually in a centennial volume of papers published for the U.S. Geological Society of America, actually. And this one was about North America since deglaciation. And I and Tom Webb and Eric Grimm were able to publish a series of maps that were quite dramatic, showing the period, the changes in vegetation since deglaciation. And at the same time, Eric Grimm and I had written a paper just a year or two before in which by accident, really, or happenstance, we just stumbled upon a way to measure the rate of vegetation change. How, we realized that there were times when the vegetation was changing very rapidly and other times when things were changing quite slowly. And we did this in one site from Minnesota. But later on, for this 1987 GSA paper, In addition to those beautiful maps that we published, we compiled information about rates of change in the vegetation from sites all over Eastern North America, and we were able to show that there were three or four times since the end of the last ice age when all the vegetation changed very rapidly at the same time. And that means places as different as Texas and Maine and Minnesota and Florida were all changing rapidly with very different vegetation, which means that there had to be some broader forcing, or likely there was some broader forcing causing those adjustments in the vegetation to happen. Well, that was really important climate information. So that was identifying times of abrupt climate change in several instances. And that started a whole line of research that we pursued for a number of years. And that was, I think that was a very significant contribution because it's now led to a lot of other kinds of studies of abrupt climate change that are still going on. And, of course, with different kinds of ice core records and so forth, the resolution is just incredible. Another thing that happened in the early 1990s, I was involved with several colleagues in studying a lake called Lake Tulane in central Florida. And that lake has, going back to the time I was a grad student at Minnesota, I was helping some senior colleagues there and from other parts of the world do sediment coring in Florida to help find old lakes with continuous sedimentary records. And we had a hard time doing that because almost all lakes in Florida dried out sometime during the last ice age, and so we would find hiatuses or gaps in time in the sediments. But we were constantly looking for at least one lake that had a continuous long-term record. And we finally found a sediment core from this lake, Lake Tulane, in halfway down the Florida Peninsula, that had a record that turned out to be about 60,000 years long, continuous record. And we, in the process of getting this thing studied, we had the pollen diagram, and it turns out it had some big swings in the vegetation back and forth between lots of pine and then not much pine and lots of oak and grass and things like that. So it was alternating between obviously kind of wet and dry, and these each were lasted several thousand years, maybe even as much as 10,000 years during the last ice age, and that was puzzling because we didn't know any phenomena quite that should have been going on in Florida that caused that kind of swing in hydrology and climate. But it turned out that just at that same time there was research going on ocean cores from the North Atlantic south of Greenland that revealed that there were big fluxes of icebergs coming out of Hudson's Bay into the North Atlantic, and those were identified because the sediment cores from the way out in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean south of Greenland have distinct layers of pebbles. And pebbles can only get out in the middle of the ocean if they're brought by icebergs. And they were very clearly defined in time, and after several of those cores were studied, and it was realized that this was a phenomenon that was quite distinct. These were dated, and it was first recognized by a German scientist named Heinrich. So these became known as Heinrich events, these big iceberg flushes that were coming out of, it turned out, Hudson's Bay. And this was known because the pebbles themselves were of rocks that came out of Hudson's Bay straight. So that's sort of neat sleuthing. And so this was a phenomenon that brought a lot of interest in the behavior of the Laurentide Ice Sheet, which is, of course, the one that covered us here in Maine. And so how did this happen, and why were these warm times when the ice was flushing out, or were they colder times? Or, you know, people could think of a bunch of hypotheses, and so that was a big series of research going on by the glaciologists and paleoceanographers at the time. Well, it turned out that these swings in vegetation in Florida exactly matched the Heinrich events. And nobody had any clue that the Heinrich events had any kind of expression beyond just the northern North Atlantic. So we published a paper in Science in 1993 that pointed out this correspondence. And that was a big deal because these Heinrich events were really a major phenomenon. And this showed that they had an expression well beyond, way down in the subtropics. Something was going on related to them. So, which could have been causal either way. I mean, nobody knew. But the timing was right there. So we got some more grants and went down and got some new cores from Lake Tulane and really looked hard at what was going on in those in the vegetation in Florida during these times. We got lots more radiocarbon dates. We did lots more work on the lake itself. And turned out to our surprise that what we found was that during the times that the icebergs were flooding out of into the North Atlantic, you know, a greater version of what caused the Titanic to sink, you could say, those were the times when Florida became warm and wet, which, you know, we could have thought, well, it would make sense for it to be maybe wet and cold or something like that, but turns out it was warm and wet, and the times in between were cold and dry. And so this was big news, and so we published a very interesting paper, a series of papers about that that talked about the lakes and this relationship, and that led to a number of other papers, even up to just the last year or two, that have demonstrated that in fact the cold icebergs coming out of the Arctic, which brought a freshwater layer on the surface, blocked the flow of the Gulf Stream warm waters that normally go up into the Norwegian Sea and carry the heat from the low latitudes up to the Arctic. And because this flush of icebergs that came down stopped this flow of warm water, the warm water quit being carried away from Florida, which made Florida warm and wet. That's why it got warm, because that heat could not be drawn away from there in the Gulf Stream current, basically. And so and modeling has shown that hypothesis is probably what it was. And so that led to, that really was a pretty important contribution to understanding the broader global phenomenon of vegetation change, but even the global behavior of the oceans and atmosphere and ice at one time. And then that led even more recently to a project that Steve Norton and I just did, a whole other interdisciplinary project. We go to coffee just about every day and still do. We both retired on the same day 5.5 years ago, and but still come in and have fun. And after all this work had gone on in the Lake Tulane core, and we had all the radiocarbon dates and all this vegetation history and understanding of the climate change, the sediment, we still had lots of sediment left because we'd collected lots of cores and larger cores. We made special coring devices so we'd have lots of material. And so really, that core, the remainder of that core became especially valuable because there was so much background information already about it. And we thought, you know, it'd be interesting to look at the deposition of mercury in the environment going back 60,000 years, because this is long before humans were even in North America, long before industrial pollution. What were the natural changes in mercury coming in from the atmosphere in central Florida during a time when we know these climate shifts were going on, but how did that affect mercury? And so we got some funding for that and did some analysis. The U.S. Geological Survey down in Florida actually helped partly with this. But we did some analyses of mercury and a number of other elements in those cores, which were, because they were so well dated, were easy to match up. And then it turned out that we found out in looking at the data of mercury that there was a phenomenon nobody had even known about mercury deposition in soils and sediments, because we found two times during deglaciation when there were pulses of mercury coming into Lake Tulane that were equal to modern pollution levels. And humans were not involved at all. And it turned out that, well, probably more information than we need here, but when during the last ice ages, when last ice age at the maximum, when sea level had been drawn down about 120 to 140 meters because of all the water taken out of the oceans to build the ice sheets, the water table on the whole Florida Peninsula had dropped, and that's why all the lakes became dry, except this one deep lake that we had found. And the drying happened especially when the seawater fell below about minus 50 meters, because that's where the continental shelves become exposed. And so the nearest water became much farther away. And so there was less support for the groundwater table in Florida. Well, during all that time, the soil in around Lake Tulane was collecting small amounts of mercury. We discovered what the background levels of deposition were, and they were small but consistent through time. But it turns out that for about 100,000 years, that small amount was falling on dry, sandy soil and accumulating there in an oxide form. And it wasn't until the groundwater table rose again during deglaciation and those soils were flooded that the mercury was released, went into the groundwater and into the lakes. Now, that sounds a bit esoteric and arcane, except for the fact that rising sea level today and in the next 100 or 200 years is going to flood areas all over the world that have dry soils that have been accumulating lots of heavy metals, both through natural processes and after human recent pollution. And as those get flooded, these are going to be released. And we actually think that the big arsenic problem in Bangladesh is related to this exact thing. And anyway, we published a paper in a big-time chemistry journal this last year about this whole phenomenon. It was a huge surprise to us to find this. We thought we were just going to be documenting this low background level of mercury for 60,000 years. And that alone, everybody thought was a big deal. But when we found this whole other phenomenon nobody knew about, of this accumulation in dry soils that could then be released, that was something nobody thought about, and it has global consequences. So it's the fun way that science unexpectedly, yeah, you know, leads us from one thing to another. But that started with that Lake Tulane core that came about way back.
Yeah. Well, I gather from the things that we've talked about that you haven't really run into any major stumbling blocks or obstacles in your time here. Is there anything that you could point to that maybe was a bit of a hurdle or...
I really have never felt any impediments, none. And I feel like my colleagues are the same. We've been able to collaborate with historians, geologists, archaeologists, math, you know, computer scientists. Jim, I didn't even mention Jim Fastook's modeling. Ice sheet model. The main ice sheet model is extremely famous, and it's used all over the world to understand how ice sheets behave and even how the ice sheets on Mars behave. I mean, it's quite something. It really is, yeah, really a big deal. And all developed as part of our, you know, he started that when he was a PhD student here in physics, but working with our institute. And it's just another example of how we've been able to, you know, share interests and support one another across disciplines. And I honestly, I really, you know, I'm not one to find roadblocks very quickly.
Well, think, what about things like state and federal support?
Well,
or university systems support? Has that ever been an issue for the institute?
Well, we've always wished there would be more state support. We, you know, federal support, we've had to go get. Now, we've been pretty good at it. You know, right now the success rate at NSF for proposals is about 10%. It's tough. And it takes a long time to write a proposal, months to write a proposal, and then it's, you know, practically a year process to start writing it and then find out whether it's funded or not and then start again. But, you know, that's so it can be pretty discouraging and daunting for sure. But our institute averages 80% success. And so when that's the case, you know, we seem to know what we're doing. And I feel like the key is to have good ideas and be able to execute and be productive. And we've really done a good job, I think, of hiring people and having students who were able to do it. And we've made a few hard decisions, but that's what it takes for any academic unit to be strong, is to be willing to sometimes say no when things aren't working. It's very painful, but for the most part, we've been very careful in our hiring to try to find people who fit, not only because they're good, smart people who can be good scientists, but colleagues who are willing to be interacting with us and one another. I mean, we don't expect to always be collaborating with each other, but we at least like to be able to have conversations easily and be on each other's students' committees and things like that. And a lot of times, you know, in our careers, we have collaborated. And I think that's a big part of it. We've been supportive of one another, and I think, you know, if we could have had stronger state support, we probably could have done a little more. But on the other hand, we've been able to make the case to university administrators over time that investments they made in us for a new something or other would pay off, and we had a track record that showed we might be right, and that we generally have been. So those decisions, you know, as I said earlier, make them look good. People like to support success, and we never went around whining about lack of support, even though, of course, we'd have liked more this and that, but it's up to us to do it. I've always felt that our place in the university and in the universe is up to us, really, because no matter how bad the budget situation is for the state or how bad the economy is, if we're doing a great job of teaching and getting grants and publishing papers and working with our students, nothing can hurt us. We will be successful, and that's happened. It's happened.
And there was a time when you and some other faculty went to the legislature, mm-hmm. and were successful in getting some research funds. Could you just talk briefly about that?
Well, that was another... It was something really not related to the Institute.
Okay.
Even though some Institute people were involved, Dave Smith in particular, and Steve Norton, who's now involved. But this was back in the mid-1990s. We'd gone through severe budget problems. The economy of Maine had been bad, and then the state had been, the legislature and the governors had been cutting our budgets. And we were losing positions like crazy. And by 1996, we had lost almost 500 positions on this campus. We'd undergone 9 budget cuts in 5 years, and which meant some of them were done during the year after we'd already put money aside for things. It was really awful. And it was a very depressing situation, very depressing. And nobody understood that this didn't have to be. And my experience in Washington had helped me understand budget cycles and the political process and so forth. And I'd never involved myself in that sort of thing here in the academic world. But I decided somebody better do something. So I did some thinking and got several colleagues together. That group became known as the Faculty Five. And which was myself, Steve Norton, Dave Smith, Mac Hunter, and George Markovsky. And I suggested to that group that we could make a case to the legislature and the state that investing in Maine, the University of Maine as a research university, was critical for the future of the state's economy. And that was the simple point to be made. Other states had done this way back at the end of World War II when NSF was designed and invented to distribute competitive funding, but Maine never really made that investment to make us very competitive. And we happened to have a few small pockets of competitive science thanks to the fact that Hal did what he did and the university supported it back in the early 70s, but that was almost a one-time thing. So we... Anyway, I put together a plan, 18-month plan, to change the thinking in Augusta, and gave talks all over the state and talked to people who were running for office the next fall, and got people in both parties to agree that this was a high priority. And so, sure enough, it led to quite a big change in funding for the university. Up till now, it's actually meant $500 million coming into the university we wouldn't have had from the state.
And this is the MEIF fund?
Well, that's a little bit of it.
Oh, that's only a little bit of it?
Mm-hmm. It's only $12 million a year.
Oh, okay. Didn't realize that.
The first 2 years, there were almost no direct research funds, but the budget and the governor at the time didn't even support it very much. But the legislature, to try to be helpful, increased the governor's budget by 2.5% 1 year and I think 2% the next year, the base budget for all of higher education. And those increases are still there, being compounded. And that turns out to be a lot of money. Plus, in addition to the MEIF money, which is a discrete amount of money that's there every year to support specific research things, and it's accounted for in a very specific way. There have been related bonds, research bonds, that have allowed the building of research buildings all over this campus that are the basis for what's happening now and the reason we've gone from $15 million to over $100 million in funding now in research activity. And that's all...
And that's university-wide,
yes.
Those figures.
Yeah. And that's come about, that was all because of this effort. And that's hundreds of millions of dollars of buildings that we wouldn't have had, as well as this base budget support, which people don't even know about, really.
Right.
But the whole budget, of the university was in such a bad shape that the whole place actually benefited enormously, still benefits enormously from it. But anyway, it led to some specific funding for research as well.
You're listed as a state climatologist. What does mm-hmm. that mean?
Well, it means that when I retired in 2008, my arm was twisted to do this. Maine doesn't actually have a state climatologist that gets paid or anything. And I'm calling it an honorary position. It's something like being the poet laureate. It's a great honor, and it gives me an opportunity to give lots of talks. And I've used it, actually, to... I led a process that led Governor Baldacci eventually to ask us to do a report about Maine's future climate changes in this century. So we published a report in 2009 called Maine's Climate Future that is a sort of a starting point for adaptation planning for all the changes that are coming. And that's led to me giving dozens and dozens and dozens of talks. I put thousands of miles in my personal car every year because I don't have a budget or anything. I'm giving talks all over the state of Maine and New England, really. And because there are people in communities and land trusts, and I've talked to oil company boards and you name it, people who are worried about how they should be adjusting, you know, forestry outfits, how should they be adapting to climate change, and how should they be planning. And that's what they need to be thinking about. And so I give them, I've got a talk that I think is pretty good. I vary it all the time, but it gives people a long-term perspective on why things are changing and how they are likely to be changing and what things they should be thinking about now, because we make lots of decisions in society that have implications decades into the future, and climate ought to be part of those decision-making processes. And that's what I'm doing. So that's what it means, is that I communicate with people all around the state of Maine and elsewhere to help them understand this larger problem mm-hmm. and whether it really matters or not.
So what kind of reception have you been getting?
It's really excellent. I've had, even when I talked to the oil company board of directors and officers, afterwards the president of the company said he changed his outlook, his understanding of climate 180 degrees based on it. Oh, it doesn't mean they're going to quit selling oil, but they understand it. And I have a way of explaining it so that people understand it. And my goal is that when I give these talks, I want everybody there to understand it themselves. I don't want them taking my word for anything. Mm-hmm. I want them to understand the simple, basic science of it, which I can do. And I can do that. I've got a way of doing it and showing them some long-term data that are very compelling. And all of a sudden, from then on, they can put what's in the newspapers in a perspective, or what somebody says on TV, because it's a pretty simple story, really. And I've got a great reception, and I've had people come up every time telling me this is the first time they've ever understood this issue. And so it makes me feel good that I can at least help people understand the problem. I don't have any answers for them, but I'm trying not to give answers either. I don't have solutions, because the policy solutions are really difficult, and they're challenges for humanity, not for, I mean, we all are part of it, but we have to solve it together too. But it has to start with people at least understanding that there's a problem.
Yeah. There have been some interesting things I've seen in the New York Times or whatever, of some ideas that people have about how to fix things.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I saw was some kind of pavement they're using in Belgium that soaks up CO2 and things like that. What do you think about some of those?
Well,
do you pay attention to that?
Sure. I'm curious, because people are always coming up with engineering solutions to things. But the quantities of carbon going into the atmosphere are so enormous. There are ways to remove it, but there really aren't ways to remove it without requiring energy to do it either, which is another problem. There are ways to remove it, and there could be a scrubber-like apparatus that would remove the carbon from a smokestack, for example, and make some kind of chalky substance, some kind of carbonate substance that has to be then put somewhere. Where does it go? Well, it's a lot of stuff. I mean, just the amount that would be produced every year would fill I think it's Lake Huron and Lake Ontario basins. But that's because these trains, these half-mile or longer trains that come out of Wyoming filled with coal to all the power plants are, you know, coming continuously across. And every one of these coal-fired power plants, which are all over the country and now all over the world, uses one or two of those train loads a day. So every time a train goes by, think of all that stuff. What are we going to do with all that stuff that we're taking out? Sure, we can take a little bit out in pavement in Belgium or and make some powdery stuff with complicated, expensive apparatus that does that. But this is we've already put more than half a billion tons of carbon into the atmosphere during the Industrial Revolution and since. And by 2050, it'll be at least a trillion. This is over half of it has been put in the last 25 years. And it's happening right now. So this is serious business.
So do you see any sort of natural phenomenon that might change that?
Well, not any good ones. Well, part of the problem here is that it's all about people. And one of the neat figures in our report, figure 5, shows the last 5,000 years of time. And it shows human population on the top curve, and then following it, a bunch of chemical signals from ice cores and so forth. And the human population, you know, before a little over 100 years ago, had never been over 1 billion people. And it was well below that for most of it. We passed 7 billion, we're at 7.2 right now, we passed 7 billion last year, and we passed 6 billion in 1999. And it's going to be now 10 by 2050 and probably 11 by the end of the century. I heard that this morning. That's a lot of people. And they're all trying to live the way we do. The middle class is growing in all these countries that are trying to develop their economies, and that's only done by energy. So China is buying coal from Wyoming. China has now built 4 terminals, ship terminals, on the Pacific Northwest coast to take Wyoming coal to China. And there are going to be trains running almost continuously across Montana taking the coal to go to China. Well, somebody will make a lot of money doing that, but every time a train goes by, it's just going up in the air. Every time. Mm-hmm. And that's what it means. And so this is not getting easier, it's getting harder. And the CO2 curve exactly looks like the human population curve. So does the methane curve, so does the others. And that's because it's all related to us. And this has never happened before. This is a novel experiment for Earth to have 7.2 billion people growing. And, you know, we aren't so aware of it in Maine, but we add a Maine worth of population to the Earth every 5 days. We add 2 Californias every year. 2 Californias, or 2 Canadas, which are the same, every year to the world's population. And those are all people who want to live the way we do. And who are we to tell them not to? Well, we haven't come up with very good solutions. And all the discussions about sustainability work around the edges, but never look at the fundamental question of what is the number? That's the question. What is the number? What's the sustainable number? I don't think it's 10 or 11 billion. Pretty sure it's not. And how are we going to do this? So young people today have some challenges. We all do, but young people will be, fortunately, lots of smart ones will be figuring out how to solve this problem, but they better do it soon.
It's funny that, I mean, funny, it's odd that there's still so much political discourse against the idea of climate change.
Well, it's not intellectual discourse, though. It's economic. Mm-hmm. That's all it is. No, I mean, the people who are pretending that this is in dispute know better.
Yeah.
You know, because it really is simple. The issue is people don't want to have their source of income affected. And there are lots of people who make a lot of money because of fossil fuel, one kind or another. And somebody will, there are discussions about things like carbon taxes and so forth. Probably something like that will ultimately happen, and everybody's behavior will change pretty sharply, and people will be innovating and finding, I mean, one thing I've said is that when there are 10 billion people, there are going to be quite a few who are really smart. And good thing. And not only that, if every time somebody has a good idea, everybody else on Earth is going to know about it 30 seconds later because
That's true.
Tweeting and everything. So there will be, if we can think of something we should all do, we can start doing it fast. But it's going to take some pretty fundamental change in the way we live, because we just can't be driving around and flying around. And we're all guilty. I mean, we all know this. I mean, I know it intellectually, but I still fly off to Norway to go cross-country skiing and stuff like that. We do this. And it's, you know, doesn't work, really. We can even develop, you know, having better light bulbs and driving Priuses and things, sort of a minor step in the right direction.
Solar powered
airplanes. But it doesn't do much. It doesn't
yeah.
really do anything in the big scheme of things. And
so it's going to take some big changes.
It is. I think so. And so the big question then, to come back to what you said earlier, is whether there will be some natural changes that will be involved. And there could be, because the human population won't continue to grow forever. And it may be that it won't stay 10 or 11 billion. But if sometimes I've phrased the question this way, can all this be resolved peaceably? And I don't know the answer. That is sort of the fundamental answer question, because if there are billions of people who don't even have water to live in Africa, and we have surplus water in Maine, this will affect us. It will. There will be ships. I'm almost sure there will be ships, tanker ships, trying to take water from Maine to other parts of the world pretty soon. And we haven't even started thinking seriously about how we're going to deal with that. We let companies just take the water and sell it for a huge amount of money, and the state gets nothing for it right now. It makes no sense to me. I mean, water is more valuable than oil. And at least the state should be getting rich from this and using it to support universities and schools and things like that, but we're not. We're just letting it go. But that probably will change. But there could be some real difficult political problems, or health, or wars, who knows? I mean, there are a lot of ways we could get to a smaller population on Earth that wouldn't be very pleasant.
Right.
And I think the challenge is to figure out a way to do it so that we can do it peaceably and people can live sustainably at some level, lower population level.
One last question for now. Do you see the Institute's mission and goals evolving in the future in any particular direction?
Well, it's evolved a lot. You know, there have been several phases in our growth. That first original 10 people and our focus on the quaternary was a great thing, and it worked really well for 25 years or more. I mean, really into the 90s and even into the 2000 decade. About the time we recruited Paul Majewski to come and we started doing ice core work seriously, it was also the time when the whole global warming issue, greenhouse gases and so forth, came to the forefront nationally and internationally, and our work became relevant, more visibly relevant in that way to people. We changed the nature of our institute quite a lot. When I stepped down as director a few years after Paul got here, a few years before I retired, we still were largely looking at the past. But when Paul became director, he immediately broadened the perspective. He helped us get the name changed so that, first of all, we didn't have that odd word quaternary stuck on there that nobody could pronounce or understand
or spell.
But he said, you know, we all study climate change. Let's put it in there because that's what we do, and then people will find us. And he was exactly right. That was definitely right. But he quickly expanded the scope of what we do to include a lot of things related to modern systems. And so we have ecologists and all kinds of scientists and political scientists and others who are looking at what's happening in the world today with climate, you know, the consequences of climate change on human populations in all different aspects and natural systems. And that was a big change for us that, first of all, broadened the perspective of what we're doing and brought in a lot more people. So we now, instead of having 10 or 12 or 14 of us, now we have dozens of people from around campus and colleagues from elsewhere who were attached, who are doing things that are relevant to understanding climate change today and what's coming in the future and how to prepare for that and how systems work. So it's really quite a major change in who we are. And, you know, we can no longer sit around this table literally as a faculty and talk about things every couple of weeks the way we used to do for years. And it has changed who we are, and it's made it more difficult in some ways for us to be a cohesive whole, because it takes a lot more work to interact with that many more people regularly, and so it doesn't happen, really. It can't happen quite as much as we used to do. We still try to have, we have our annual Bourne Symposium in the spring. That's a great way of us connecting with one another. We still have a fall field trip of some kind that gets us together. But the challenges of interacting across campus are greater than they've ever been. And in fact, in our talk at the Bourne Symposium this year, I made a plea to everybody to think very hard about how to do this and how to continue to make that effort, because it's very easy to be so busy that we don't have time to go to a seminar from some other related discipline. And and we all are busy and we travel, so it takes a special effort to be part of this great institution, and I hope we can keep doing it.
The last thing I'll ask you today is there anything you wanted to tell me that I didn't ask you about?
Well, I can't think of anything right now.
Okay. We may ask for a follow-up interview at
some
point.
You're more than welcome.
This has been great. Reminded me of a lot of things I've forgotten about.
I'm sure.
And I'm going to ask you to sign our release, and so we'll end now. Thank you.